Katrina Vandenhovel is the editor of The Nation, which proudly proclaims itself to be the oldest weekly magazine in the United States. Her latest book, The Change I Believe in, Fighting for Progress in the Age of Obama, is a compilation of her columns in The Nation and The Washington Post. It's published by Nation Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings Ms. Vandenhovel to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Your title, The Change I Believe in, is obviously related to the Obama campaign slogan, Change We Can Believe In. What are your feelings about how he's delivered on the changes that he promised?
You know, this is a Rorschach question.
It starts us off.
The expectations were so very high, Leonard, and I think my book is very much about the importance of movements and the change from below, fused with politicians of principle and conviction inside. I think President Obama passed two major pieces of legislation, the health care bill, the financial reform. Neither were commensurate with the scale of the crisis this country confronts, partly because of the lobbies, the status quo corporate money, which diluted those. But also, I think we see in his administration the limits of the system. I think it will take more than one election to change the parameters of our system. And I think also the limits of the person, the leadership. We didn't get, despite all the obstructions in our system and a nihilist Republican Party, President Obama, I think, failed to tell us a story, a narrative about the challenges this country faced and unify that for people.
And isn't he paying a price for that? His approval ratings are down. The only reason some people say he may win re-election is just that the potential candidates from the Republican Party are not all that strong.
You're kind in the way you describe not all that strong, clueless, unable to come up with ideas or solutions for the problems this country faces. But today there's a story in the Washington Post about how President Obama, his base, is still strong in many ways, that his approval ratings are similar to those of other presidents who, you know, face troubles, Clinton at this time. But I think, you know, the important thing is he's beginning to speak about what to me is the national emergency of our times, joblessness. He's beginning to speak more boldly. And I was interested that just a week or so ago, as you may have covered on this show, that due to the mobilizing and the movement around the Keystone Pipeline, that has now been postponed. And I think there's a responsiveness to change from below, to movements, which we haven't seen as much out of a White House that became too technocratic.
Your subtitle is Fighting for Progress in the Age of Obama, which sounds like you're still saying that there's a certain amount of resistance that we have to fight.
Oh, I think this country is a story of the ongoing fight for freedom. Our editorial board member, Eric Foner's book, The History of Freedom, is how you don't give up. Politics, to use a cliche, if I might, is not a spectator sport. You don't just go cast your vote and sit back. Citizens have to remain engaged. And as we're seeing now with not just Occupy Wall Street, but the hundreds of Occupy encampments around this country, the ability of people to say enough and raise issues that have been off the media and political radar in ways they need to be on, obscene inequality, downward social mobility, asking that those who made this economic crisis be held accountable, that comes from continued engagement and fighting.
You've said that the role of the nation is to be a progressive, dissenting, swashbuckling alternative forum for ideas. The word progressive seems to be replacing the word liberal in many people's vocabulary.
That's interesting. I don't remember using the word swashbuckling, and if I might, I was just rereading a great speech our civil rights correspondent Martin Luther King Jr. gave in 1967, where he called for the need for a band of creative dissenters. The nation is truly independent, founded by abolitionists in 1865, as you mentioned. So we're across a spectrum on the political spectrum. I mean, I'd say it's a tent, a big tent. Liberals, progressives, radicals, anarchists, conservatives with conscience. But I guess if there's a distinction, too often liberals haven't taken their own side in an argument, and progressives have perhaps more faith in the people to come up with their solutions to their own problems, whereas liberals sometimes more top-down. But that's...
Well, how do you respond to the application of the word socialist to so many people, to the point where Michelle Bachmann not only has called President Obama a socialist, but now she recently accused all of the other Republican candidates of being soft socialists?
She has a way with words. I write in the book, I have a column about being on television with Michelle Bachmann on the eve of the 2008 election, where she used other terms such as rooting out un-Americans in Congress and in the Obama family. Not very American. The term socialist, it gets bandied about. It's misunderstood. I think social democracy in Europe is in many ways a very humane system. What interests me is that in polls, young people, partly because they hear Obama being labeled a socialist so often, support the idea of socialism without actually investigating and exploring. But we need to get beyond these brands and categories and stereotypes.
There was a lot of press recently about polls that indicated that more people would like to see a communist system in this country than support the members of Congress. I think it was 9% Congress, 12% for communism or something like that, which struck me as
there
really
you have
odd.
It. But, you know, what interests me about these discussions is we talk about capitalism. You're talking communism, we're talking You know, there are many different kinds of capitalism, and we're living in what I would call a kind of crony capitalism. And the fight, the search, the quest for a more democratic, humane if capitalism is one that is in some ways at the heart of the Occupy Wall Street movement and the movement of those who believe that our priorities in this country are so disconnected from the actual problems.
Did Mayor Bloomberg's clearing of Zuccotti Park give it a new life, do you think?
Well, let me just step back for a moment. We had the former Seattle police commissioner, who was the police commissioner during the WTO protests of 1999, where there was truly a kind of paramilitary policing of those protests. I think what we're seeing is, you know, there is a strength in being ousted from the space. One of the great slogans is, you cannot evict an idea whose time has come. But I think this is a moment when we should also look at the policing in this, not only this city, but in this country. And how do we rethink what has become a kind of paramilitary policing structure? We saw this in California, UC Davis this past weekend with the pepper spray. So that there be some discussion about police police forces. And, you know, there are communities in this city, Leonard, you know this, who have confronted police abuse in just the normal course of their lives, people of color. The fact that there were 50,000 marijuana arrests last year in the city shows the connection between a kind of failed drug war and the status of policing. But I think Bloomberg's eviction of protesters has now moved the discussion to how do you build the ideas that are so central to advancing this movement and not just fetishizing the space.
Well, you mentioned the pepper spraying. Videos of them have gone viral on the internet. But we just had an article, an op-ed piece in the New York Times the other day from Robert Haas, former poet laureate of America, about his being beaten or clubbed by a cop. Do you think that this is going to scare people, or is it creating a kind of a martyr sensibility?
You know, I think part of what is important is that we keep our eyes on the prize, which is the issues that occupy, and its many moving parts, and the movements allied with it are focusing on. But we cannot ignore the fact that when the 1%, so to speak, or establishment power centers are confronted, that this is the way they respond to nonviolent, peaceful protest.
My guest is Katrina Vandenhoevel. Her latest book is called The Change I Believe In, Fighting for Progress in the Age of Obama, published by Nation Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Many people on the left have complained about the way that the mainstream media have covered Occupy Wall Street, ignoring it for a long time. Then in the case of the New York Times, which is many people consider to be a seriously liberal newspaper, kind of dismissing it as rather silly. What was her name? Gianna?
We were talking today in the Nation's editorial meeting. You know, in the first days, there was a sense of condescension or snarkiness about it. But certainly the New York Times in these last 2 months has covered the movement seriously. And what is so powerful is how Occupy has shifted the national debate so that you have, for example, terms like income inequality, which were off the radar. You'd hear deficit austerity, but not income inequality, soaring, so that 500% more usage of such terms. So if you can shift the national debate, for me, as I think for you in the media, people people are getting a reality from what they're hearing on the media. So if they're beginning to hear terms and ideas that they didn't hear before, it could shift the politics in important ways.
Do you think that has also affected the way the big six in broadcasting have covered these things? GE, NBC, Disney, ABC, Fox News Corp, Time Warner, Viacom, CBS?
It's a very good question. I mean, part of the work we've done at The Nation over the last 20 years is map the consolidation and the corporatization of the media. It's more complicated now, and I write a little bit about this sort of in this column on the media, intellectuals, high, low, pop culture. But, you know, we have a media system now where people are making their own news. There's alternative news. But, you know, on MSNBC yesterday morning, our former Washington correspondent Chris Hayes leaked a story about how there's a lobbying operation in Washington which is peddling its wares to smear Occupy Wall Street. You have on MSNBC some reporting that wasn't there 10, 15 years ago about these issues like accountability, income inequality, joblessness, not austerity. But the corporate media is still locked in, for the most part, to a parameter of debate and locked into a kind of coverage of politics as a horse race. So they have a harder time, as we've seen, covering movements and covering ideas.
And a major criticism we've heard again and again from all different media sources is that the Occupy Wall Street people have no specific policy goals and they have no leaders.
Well, you know, I think it's both generational. I mean, you know, people from the 60s want to know where the issues are, where the demands are, where the leaders are. This is a new kind of movement. But I think what it has done, Occupy Wall Street, is supercharged the landscape and brought into sharp relief those movements and groups which have ideas. The ideas are there. So Occupy raises the attention, shines a light on issues, and it will evolve. This is an evolving movement. And if I might just back on the mainstream media or the corporate media, you know, it's not a mainstream media anymore if it treats issues that vast majorities of people say they support. For example, increasing taxes on the very wealthy, protecting Social Security or Medicare, jobs, not cuts. If those are treated as sort of left of center by a mainstream media, that's not a mainstream media.
Well, haven't most of the Democrats in Washington been wary of making a strong show of support to Occupy Wall Street, in contrast to the way the Republicans have embraced the Tea Party?
I would say that inside Congress, you have three Democratic parties. You have the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, as late Senator Paul Wellstone used to call it, so that you have a progressive caucus, for example, 91 members who put out a people's budget, which in many ways is a kind of Occupy Wall Street budget, which countered this super committee, which fortunately, in failing, will succeed, in my view, to not damage our economy further. So, yes, but you are right. Many Democrats, many establishment Democrats are wary of aligning themselves with a movement that is leaderless. On the other hand, they're aligning themselves with labor unions, which are in coalition with Occupy Wall Street. So it's a much more fluid landscape than, for example, you know, during the Vietnam War, I'm sure you remember, to come out into the street and see construction workers beating up hippies. Today, those workers, that labor movement, is a very different kind of labor movement.
Well, this is being called a populist movement, as was the Tea Party, by the way. But it seems to me Democrats are very uncomfortable with populism these days.
The establishment Democratic Party is not comfortable with populism. However,
Obama was promoted as a populist candidate, but he's not been a populist president.
He was promoted in many ways as a progressive, pragmatist president. He spoke less about economic populism than he did about a different kind of politics of including people, as a former community organizer he was would speak of. But no, he doesn't really have a populist bone in his body. But, you know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and I understand it was a different country then. The labor movement was much stronger. But he was the deficit-balancing governor of New York when he came into the White House to confront the extraordinary crisis of the Great Depression. So my view in this book is it takes movements to push political leaders, presidents, beyond the limits of their own politics. And you're not going to get what, you know, you can't always get what you want. You usually don't get what you want. And That's where the power of movements comes.
But if you try some time, you might get what you need.
But you do have, I sit in my office with people who often, you know, they don't have much use. And certainly I think the Occupy Wall Street, one, doesn't have an electoral ambition. That will take other movements around it, like to be like the progressive Tea Party, though I hate that parallel. But you do have good people in Congress, like Bernie Sanders, who I quote extensively in my book, who speaks to the issues of Occupy.
But he's not a Democrat.
Elizabeth Warren is running for a Democratic seat in Massachusetts. She is an unapologetic populist who also has this great ability to put in very human language why we need a strong government on the side of the people, not rigged against them.
I'm going to come back to Elizabeth Warren and some other issues when we return to this conversation. My guest is Katrina Vandenhoevel, who is the editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. Her latest book, The Change I Believe In, Fighting for Progress in the Age of Obama, published by Nation Books. Stay with us. We're back with Katrina Vandenhoevel. Her latest book, a collection of columns she's written for The Nation, where she is the editor and publisher, also for The Washington Post, where she is neither. The book, Change I Believe In, Fighting for Progress in the Age of Obama, published by Nation Books. You mentioned Elizabeth Warren. Many of the people who supported President Obama from Wall Street, like the people from Goldman Sachs and the like, are now supporting very strongly Elizabeth Warren's the man she's running against, Scott Brown, in Massachusetts. So the money goes in all sorts of different directions, doesn't it?
Well, it does. You know, I mean, the money goes from Wall Street right now in majority ways to a Republican Party that has literally sent its people, like John Boehner, to meet with Wall Street representatives and tell them that they're on their side. So I think you see a Wall Street which, you know, just because President Obama called them fat cats, says that they're insulted and humiliated and will never support him. What we're seeing again in this moment is an understanding that those who made this economic mess should help pay for its cleanup. Does it surprise that Wall Street's flocking to Scott Brown, Elizabeth Warren's opponent? No, because she knows where the bodies are buried. She speaks very powerfully about holding Wall Street accountable, not destroying Wall Street, but holding it accountable so that ordinary people who don't have representatives can be can have a countervailing force vis-a-vis this Wall Street.
But didn't he also, President Obama, kind of abandon her?
Here's another disappointment. But you know, we should have known those who supported President Obama saw in him someone who came to national attention, speaking of their, you know, a unified America, not a red America, a blue America. President Obama failed to pick fights, and sometimes you need to pick fights that you might lose, but you do to raise larger issues that capture the national imagination. Elizabeth Warren was a fight he should have had with a Republican Party, which said they would not confirm her. She played a role, too. I think she was ready to go run in Massachusetts, but she has remained supportive of the president. And the question that interests me, if I could, Leonard, is the New York Times Magazine profile yesterday by an interesting young woman writer, Rebecca Traister, raises a question that's at the heart of my book. Will someone like an Elizabeth Warren, who has the power of principle and conviction and speaks also in populist ways, will she be able to make change in an institution like the Senate, which is so hobbled by the power of money, of entrenched status quo, and the abuse, by the way, of institutions like the filibuster, which has been used more, I think, in the last 2 years than it was in the 60s and 70s combined.
Well, now there's an insistence on 60 votes on pretty much everything that comes up in the Senate, as we saw in the debt ceiling situation, where in the past they just simply would all raise their hands and raise the debt ceiling. It's been done many, many times in the past.
But the picking of a fight, if a president comes in and President Obama comes in and he wants to find common ground, after about 3 or 4 months looking around and after listening to two of the leading Republicans say that their first priority was not to govern but to bring you down, at some point you kind of have a reality check moment. And whether you're a pragmatist or whatever, you realize that you got to adopt Plan B.
Well, one of the interesting things is that Barack Obama raised more money from Wall Street than any politician in American history. And this year he raised more cash from bank employees, hedge fund managers, and financial services companies than all of the Republican candidates combined. So we have this weird split. We have Occupy Wall Street criticizing the same people who have been sending money to the Obama administration, although now they seem to be moving toward Republican candidates because the Republicans are saying, we will defend your interests.
Oh, I think there's a sense in the heart of Occupy Wall Street about the corrosive impact of money in our system. In the book, The Change I Believe In, I write extensively about the reforms, the fundamental transformational reforms we need to take and make to get the money rot out of our system. And that begins with fair elections now, public financing. This city, this good city, New York City, has a good 1-6 match so that you get small donors. That's where the power is. If you can amass millions of small donors and get that corporate money out of the system. And of course, Citizens United, the destructive Supreme Court decision, we're coming up on the second anniversary, which is unleashed corporations as people and unleashed corporate treasuries to pour unlimited money into a system that's already, you know, metastasizing cash. So those are reforms that, again, President Obama has not led the way on. But Democrats have, there are good people in the Congress who are fighting. But that, to me, is at the heart of the fight ahead.
But didn't he signal that things were going to go in this direction when he appointed Timothy Geithner and Larry Summers and others to his economic team?
The tone deafness of appointing Larry Summers and Timothy Geithner is still stunning. At least President Obama promised us, as you may recall, a team of rivals. He was reading Doris Kearns Goodwin's book about Lincoln's cabinet. A team of rivals. To have brought in a Robert Reich or a Joseph Stiglitz, at least to have those fights inside. So if I had to rank my two top disappointments, it was bringing in Geithner and Summers at the beginning, because even though you then fight for some kind of financial reform bill, which was, as I said, diluted both by the system and by leadership, there's a tone deafness in that. And these people have their paw prints all over the mess.
And he stood by Timothy Geithner, despite the fact that Ron Suskind alleges in his new book, Confidence Man, that Geithner ignored an order from the president to break up Citibank or Citicorp or whatever it is, Citigroup.
It's the failure there of leadership. And the failure, it raises a question about a fundamental question about the Democratic Party. Where is the bench? Where is the field team of people President Obama could have, should have brought in instead of those who were part of the Clinton team in many ways? You know, the nation, again, independent, was very tough on President Clinton's administration, not because of impeachment and all of that, but because you saw then the beginning of the deregulation of Wall Street, which has led to derivatives, which has led to the excesses, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, so the bank's too big to fail. So, there's a bipartisan rot in our system, but how we emerge from that is one which will take both short-term action and long-term strategy. And we are working with a system that, short of a revolution, I was in Moscow 2 weeks ago. That country is immunized to revolution. I believe in peaceful, nonviolent, radical, transformational change, and I think that's what we need to work for.
But we're not going to see it in Russia, are we? But it isn't.
You never listen. Look at Egypt. Look at Egypt. No, you're not going to see it in Russia right now. But in Egypt or in Tunisia, you see there too as well. The idea here that was a revolution in Egypt. Those who had studied revolutions understood that it was Mubarakism without Mubarak, and we now see that the struggle there will demand years of.
The military in Egypt, it seems, saw the revolt against Mubarak as their opportunity to seize land and power
and property. Yeah.
In the case of the Democrats, doesn't the president also work with a handicap that the Republican leadership does not? Republicans do all pretty much fall in line when it's big issues. The Democrats have people like Ben Nelson, who votes as much for as often with the Republicans as he does with the Democrats. Joe Lieberman is part of the Democratic caucus. He supported John McCain in the last election.
As I was saying, you have inside the Democratic Party two or three Democratic parties. How that will evolve and change requires building the strength of the progressive wing, the Democratic wing. There are also regional differences, though, in this country, which are very complicated. But if you could begin by getting some of the money out of that, out of the our politics, I think you could see the beginning of a shift. I'm also excited about the beginning of movement activists understanding that they need to take that energy into the electoral arena and do it with conviction, with small contributions, and a sense of links to movements that will keep them honest.
There are some other areas where progressives seem have expressed disappointment. For example, the use of drones in Pakistan and in Yemen, matters of protecting people's rights. Guantanamo has turned out to be a major disappointment for progressives. The president promised something that he did not wind up backing up. Why do you think he keeps on backing down on these things?
Well, let me just go radical, meaning to the root of what I think is the problem, if I could, Leonard. I think the syndrome of endless war, unless we reframe the state of our foreign policy and national security and shift away from the war on terror, we are going to be locked in to this ongoing war paradigm, and that rots a democracy. And we need to reset our foreign policy. And the president has, in my mind, the drones are a very dangerous eruption of a new kind of warfare that we don't even have the institutions or the laws to catch up with. On Guantanamo, I think there was an attempt to close, but there the political capital and the question of persistence and tenacity and fighting, he didn't pursue it. But to me, the fundamental question is how do we cut a defense budget, end unnecessary wars, get off this kind of permanent war footing, and think of security in new ways? So human security, what are the great perils of the 21st century? Global pandemics, economic instability, nuclear proliferation, trafficking of resources, of bodies. These are issues which hypermilitarized methods will not deal with effectively.
Are you heartened by plans to withdraw troops from Iraq?
Yes. I mean, again, the pressure there came from inside Iraq. But the respect for a sovereign country's decision, that is meeting a promise President Obama made in the election to get out of Iraq. And he also made the promise to end the mindset that took us into Iraq. And I think there it's a more complicated issue. On Afghanistan as well, I think.
Well, he promised to go into Afghanistan.
He said it was the good war. But I think we're beginning to see the beginning of pullout. I was stunned, though, when he went to Australia last week, that he decided, you know, announced the sending of 2,500 Marines to a base. To me, the low-hanging fruit of our national security state is the 1,000 U.S. bases ringing the world at a time of such economic pain and the need to rebuild at home. The base structure is such a vestigial legacy of this national security state that should be one to end.
Now, some people would argue that the nation, on the one hand, the National Review, on the other, are preaching to their own choirs. Is that a problem? Do you really think that political magazines today, the National Review had major impact on American politics for a while, but I don't think it does anymore. Do you think that politicians are even paying attention?
Well, part of what we're about is putting on the radar, putting on the agenda, ideas whose time may not yet have come. I'm, you know, proud that we have been covering the problem of inequality in this country for 15, 20 years, or the issue of the consolidation and corporatization of media. I think these issues now are percolating in the mainstream. The anxiety about consolidation, corporatization of the media, inequality. So we
will they be issues in the next presidential campaign?
I think fairness and inequality have to be issues in the next presidential campaign. So you begin, yes, by talking to those who are your natural allies, who are your readers, but, you know, with the internet as well, and we have 1.5 million people coming to the internet each month, you have people of all kinds around this country you might not have reached before. And when they find your voice, so many of them say, this is what I was looking for, and they stick with you.
Katrina Vandenhoevel will be in conversation with Bob Herbert tonight at 7 o'clock at the Society for Ethical Culture. That's at 2 West 64th Street. This is a collection of columns that you've written. Did you find that some of them were too optimistic when you were going through the list?
I try, as I write in the introduction, to maintain an optimism grounded in the belief that there is work worth doing.
The Change I Believe In, Fighting for Progress in the Age of Obama. It is published by Nation Books, and my great thanks to Katrina Vandenhoevel, who is the editor and publisher of The Nation, for being on our show today.
Thank you.